sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Problems from the NSA breach are spreading. 6 weeks of an unbelievable defying gravity uptrend in markets. And there's no telling how many bonds will be bought by Yellen that the Treasury done be selling. Vitaly Katsenelson is our guest talking about value investing. And we got lots to talk about on episode number 339 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, greetings and how are you? This is Andrew Horowitz. And glad you can join me. We have a pretty good show, I think, lined up for today. We have a good guest we haven't had on, Vitaly, for a really long time. I don't know when the last time he was actually with us, but we are going to have him on. I had a nice weekend. I hope you did as well. It was rather interesting. Went to a charitable event, and playing at the charitable event was Night Ranger and also Joan Jett. Talk about a blast from the past. You know, when you start going to these events, I started thinking about, oh my God, I think of my father. You know, he would go to the park in the summer and listen to, like, Johnny Maestro and the Brooklyn Bridge. And I'd be like, who is that? He goes, you don't know who they are? Big. They're big. I said, I don't know who they are. And he would say, oh, they're great guys. They were big during the day. And I started thinking about, we went to an event and Joan Jett's playing in a big ballroom. What's happening? I'll show you how that. I'll take one other quick experience I had. I was at a concert. I really like Yes, and I like Rush. Well, I was listening to Yes. They were in concert down here one time. I think this was my third time seeing them down here. And Rick Wakeman, who is just a wonderful, wonderful keyboard player, just magical. Well, he was playing, and all of a sudden, I'm watching him, and he whips out a pair of bifocals, or reading glasses, to read the music, I guess, that was on his music stand as he was playing. I'm thinking, there's two problems here. First, I guess he's forgetting the music. Second, even if he's not forgetting the music, he has to put on reading glasses. I can't do this. So I looked around, and I just looked behind me, and I looked around. I said, who are all these old people at this concert? I said, wait a second. I have a bad feeling. I'm not going to these again. You know, it was really a weird, you probably had that kind of thing happen, right? You know, all of a sudden you're out of your age element, but you still like what's going on in either the genre of music or the style of dress or maybe even the place to go. It happens. Anyway, so we have a few things I want to really touch on here. We have some very interesting earnings coming out this week. I don't even know what to say at this point of why the markets continue to defy what seems to be logical limits of where they can go. I will share with you this, that last week on, I guess it was Thursday, maybe it was Wednesday, I started collecting some data. I started making some calls, and I called some mutual fund managers because I wanted to understand a little bit more about what was going inside of their funds, what was going on and how things were playing out. Like, what were they seeing? Were they really bullish? Were they really putting a lot of money to work? Was it more of a money moving in from retail, or was it, you know, what's going on? And do they even have any idea? So I spoke to a few of them. Now, this is a basic summary that I got. That when I asked this, they said that there is basically a feeling out there that until there is a major event, that the markets can continue moving higher because the Fed is behind it, the world is behind it, and there's really nowhere else to go. Even though many of the people that are investing are being pushed into those investments and possibly into the wrong asset class for the current risk, they're moving into the markets because they're moving up. And the things that we're seeing right now, for example, which are the early morning buying and the late day buying as well, are all hallmarks of retail and individual investors, mutual fund investors getting into and making their funds work with the market. And what happens then is that as they start sending money into the mutual fund companies, well, the mutual fund companies have to do something with it. So they have to deploy the assets. And as such, they have a chunk of assets and they have to put it in the markets. That's the edict by their mutual fund that they manage. Now, what this gentleman told me in one particular case was that the money was going in, but some of the managers were a little concerned about the valuations. I said, okay, that's reasonable. And they're holding back a little bit. And I said, well, tell me something. I've been hearing about the potential of everybody waiting for an event. What event could that possibly be? Is it going to be the budget situation that's coming up in January or the debt ceiling again? Because last time around, nobody seemed to care. Is it going to be some kind of a weird event in Europe? Because nobody seems to care. Is it going to be something like maybe in Japan, they slow down some of the stimulus, which I don't think is going to happen. But again, an event. What is this event? A war? What? He said that basically everybody's looking at the same thing. And that is tapering. And I said, you got to be kidding me. I mean, we were totally blasted with this information on a regular basis. Is it just because the media is making such a big deal out of this? Or what is it? He said, well, no, if you really think about it, the tapering, which isn't necessarily a really big deal in terms of markets, at least a small amount of bond purchases pulling back. The fact is, when we did see that there was an indication that Bernanke was going to pull back on the stimulus, markets had a little temper tantrum. Now, that's why they came back and retracted their statements, and why Janet Yellen has basically come in and said, hey, you know what? We're going to do it for a lot longer, if not forever. So with all of the stimulus and with all of the retail investors now looking for a home for their money and then putting it into mutual funds, what you've seen the last few weeks is a high level of inflows, which we knew about. But it's getting a little bit ridiculous because you start to get into a valuation trap where you want to be in the market, but yet at the same time, valuations don't make sense. And when you see stocks like Walmart last week coming out with a rather weak outlook, and still the stock, which was down 2 or 3% pre-market, came right back up. I think last Monday or Tuesday it was. Futures were down about 10 or 12 on the S&P 500 and finished the day up almost, I think it was about 8. It's a 20-point turn. Extraordinary. Because it is just a buy mode right now. And whether or not this goes into a parabolic move, or maybe this is a parabolic move right now, that you do see at the end, the exhaustion point of market is yet to be seen, because the question still remains, how much of the Fed's overall dynamic is going to continue to push people into, whether it's dividend paying stocks or whether it's going to allow for companies to continue working on their buybacks. We saw some big buybacks again last week. And a lot of times companies hold that back until they see some earnings falling off, which makes no sense, by the way. You know, you think they want to buy in when things are good, not when they're rolling over, but just to save the value of the stock. We're definitely seeing a lot of buybacks. So we're on 6 weeks of gains with economic data that I would say is softening a little bit. We definitely saw some factory numbers that were really a little bit lighter. We saw consumer confidence that was lighter, although the inflation measures, whether we believe them or not, the inflation measures that are put out are pretty benign. We're seeing that the cost of goods from an export-import standpoint, or the exportation of goods, a little bit higher, and the importation of goods costs less. When you look at the factory numbers, it's the input costs for that are also lower. And you're seeing that CPI and PPI, generally speaking, are rather tame. So, you know, you look at that all and you put that into the equation of, okay, what's the Fed looking for? They're looking for a low job rate. They're looking to increase inflation or at least stabilize things. And what, you know, they want more people and increase the rate of people working. And whether or not their particular tactic right now is working is another whole story. We also get Mario Draghi coming out with a 25 basis point drop in interest rates, because basically he knew that we were going to see some really terrible numbers out of Europe, which we did. Last Thursday, there was just a heap of negative numbers, or I should say at least really disappointing numbers from Europe. And you're still seeing that Japan can't pick it up, even though they've provided all the stimulus. And really, at the end of the day, when you do see that there is a significant amount of movement of the markets on bad news, you have to believe that everybody's just thinking out loud to themselves and pinching themselves, ah, stimulus. And that's why that little quip that I had there, that no telling how many bonds will be bought by Yellen that the Treasury is selling, is true. We don't know how far they're going to go with this. Because right now you can make a case very, very convincingly that there's not a problem with inflation. And the biggest issue and the biggest concern about doing this, of printing money and of quantitative easing, is the potential for hyperinflation. I think it's more remarkable that we haven't seen any of it. I'm not sure what that exactly says, because you have to think about, okay, if they are doing this, there's one of two things really that is stopping inflation from skyrocketing. The first thing is that they had to fill a hole. There was a gigantic hole, a crater that was formed after the financial industry just blew up back in 2008. And you look at that and maybe look at it as a sinkhole, just to swallow it up, and you're trying to fill that dirt in, but the sinkhole keeps on kind of taking a little bit back, and you're seeing that go on, so maybe that's the first thing. The second thing is, well, it's happening on a worldwide basis also, and the only place we're really seeing some inflationary pressures are emerging markets, which many say that is because of the U.S. and the amount of QE that we're doing here. But that on the side, it's also that we're seeing a lot of other countries do the same thing. Reduce their interest rates, bring down the currency, and as such, you don't have the inflationary pressures because everybody is debasing their currencies. If you had everybody standing pat and one country going at it and just doing all sorts of stimulus and quantitative easing, well, then you'd have a problem. Now, some of the other things that are going on behind the scenes over the weekend, we saw that China is vowing reforms for their economics. And this is really interesting because there's a couple of points of this that were, okay, you could say whatever you want. They talked about more private investment. Of course they want private investment. While they don't want to give up ownership and control of the state-owned firms and companies, they're always looking to, any country is looking to open up their doors for further investment from outsiders and private investors. Why not? They also talked about more protection for farmers. Okay, that's good. You know, about their farmland, the cost of the property, making sure that the competition is set right and that they're not just going to get run over out of nowhere. But the other thing that they mentioned, I thought, that we really have to think about is this one-child rule that they've had on for a while now, because their population obviously was getting so enormously large and was seeing exponential growth of the overall population, which is a big problem. So they have this one-child rule. They're going to slack that up a little bit. They're going to loosen up some of the rules on that. And I'm scratching my head saying, wow, really? It's not like we have a lot less people there. It's not like the population actually dropped at all. And it's not like their population isn't keeping up with the growth of the rest of the world from various areas around. So maybe what they're doing is they are regulating. This is pretty bizarre. They're regulating their economy through the amount of mouths to feed and consumption by allowing for additional pregnancy. So that's why maybe they're also wrapping into this the whole idea of protection for farmers, because what if there is food shortages, or what if there is some kind of need to expand their acreage, and maybe the government's very strict about it. They're not letting it happen. But you know what? If they're going to open up to allowing more people to be in China, and that's not overnight. I mean, you have a baby today, it's going to take a few years to get the whole thing going. But I thought that was really interesting that they're going to actually open this up and allow for a kind of a population expanse. Chinese markets really enjoy that. They were up nicely on that, and we're seeing some very volatile but very impressive moves on many of the Chinese internet providers. Now, there's a couple of reasons for that. And this comes from a discussion that was had by Cisco. John Chambers came out and talked about what's going on with the company, their earnings. Remember, they came out with earnings last, I believe it was Thursday, and stock dropped about 12%, pretty substantial drop, way back to before this year's pricing. And John Chambers seems to be a pretty upfront guy. John Chambers has always been a little bit cautious, and he continues to be so. But on his outlook that was very cautious, he talked about how some of the international buying, the international units that he has at Cisco, we're seeing a lot of problem, in particular China. And why is that? This is what was really cool. They said that because of the NSA and the breach there and the realization of what's going on, because of the spying that has been gone on, we see that Angela Merkel's phone and who knows what else is being listened to and wiretapped by the NSA. And because of the unrest that that has caused, that many companies and state-owned companies in China are not buying the gear, the technology from U.S.-based companies. That's very interesting. I didn't even think about this way back when, but that does make sense now that I think about it. When I start looking at, wow, you know what? Who knows what another country believes that even a private company, publicly traded, but private company without government backing, could put some kind of mechanism into play that would be problematic for the other country. So China seems to be not taking any chances here. They're not interested in seeing whether or not there's going to be any kind of problems. They're just going to cut it off right before it even happens. So Cisco, and who knows what other big box manufacturers or technology companies are going to be hurt by not only China's reluctance to pick up the U.S.-based products, but who knows around the world where there's going to be a backlash of this. Now, we tie that onto the fact that we're seeing that the Chinese technology companies, many of the internet-based and cloud-based, have done very well over the last few weeks. And now you're starting to see a picture emerge that, wait a minute, maybe the whole idea here is that investors around the world and in China believe that there's going to be a real problem with their China production of technology or consumption of technology. So they're going and opting for the local companies. And who knows if there's going to be some kind of edict put on by the government of China to only buy local so that they can keep better tabs on things and prevent, obviously, important information. Because not only is there the whole idea that we're seeing government espionage go on, but the corporate espionage must really spook companies. I mean, if you think about that for a second, why not be a little bit concerned about the fact that the potential for another company knowing what's going on in your company, stealing patent ideas, stealing all sorts of the research and development ideas that you have, or maybe even just poaching your employees, why have that even out there? So close it up, button it up. Let's talk a little bit before we get with our guest about some of the things that will be happening next week that I want you to be aware of. I'm finding it a little bit difficult to buy into some of these stocks right now. We have a long-short exposure. It's just, going nowhere right now in this kind of market condition. When you just see that in the morning you wake up and your shorts are doing really well, and by the afternoon your longs are doing really well, but the shorts turned around or vice versa. Usually doesn't see that kind of weirdness, but it's getting a little strange right now. And you're also seeing a lot of companies, you're seeing a lot of stocks do some very big moves on a run to the upside. And in fact, you're also seeing a lot of stocks get pummeled if they don't make earnings or there's some kind of news that comes out. So with that, starting next week, we have a good group of companies, and I think a very telling group of companies of what's going on. We have Tyson Foods, which of course is the chicken farmers. Urban Outfitters, we have Salesforce.com. Now, they've done a great job, quite an impressive job. I think this week Barron's did a slam job on them or something. But Salesforce.com has a pretty unique product, relatively unique. I have been concerned that there are other players in this market that are now trying to really take market share from them. And on one hand, you have to look at as the employment and the population grows, well, they're going to have to sell more seats, and that's how they do business. On one hand, hey, we saw that there was a better jobs number, but really there's not a lot more people working. So we have to take a look at where the technology goes with this. I think this quarter should be very interesting. Looking for about 9 cents per share, which is not very much, on about $1 billion of revenue. We have a Home Depot coming out before the market on the 19th. They're looking for about 90 cents on 19 billion. Dick's Sporting Goods on the 19th. 39 cents on 1.3 billion. Best Buy. Now, Best Buy has been on a tear. Have you watched that stock? That's nuts. I mean, really, from absolutely hated, thinking it's going to get just put out of business, to, hey, one of the best stocks of the year. They're coming out on the 19th, early in the morning, 12 cents a share, looking for on about $9.3 billion. Then we have a lot of retail coming out. Now, not only do we have retail coming out in terms of earnings, but we have retail sales coming out this week also. And retail sales, ex autos, are looking for an advance of approximately, let's see what he got here, ex autos and gas, about 0.2%. Prior is about 0.4%. Now, we'll see. It doesn't seem like the government shutdown and the lack of confidence on the consumer or the lack of any wage growth has really been a problem, but we'll see. And what I'm going to do is, let's hold off. Let's see, we're going to talk about Deere, Lowe's, we've got Staples, JCPenney, a lot of companies that I want to talk to you about, Pandora, and all the economics. But I thought, let's get to the guest and see what he has to say. I'm kind of itching to talk to him. So Vitaly Katsanelson is with us. And he is a prolific writer, very good writer, I must say. And he has a blog called The Contrarian Edge. You can see him in things like Institutional Investor Magazine, not only all over the web, but also in a lot of big publications. Weren't you in Barron's recently?
I was profiled in Barron's a few years ago, yeah.
So, Vitaly, let's talk. Now, you are a self-proclaimed or proclaimed a value investor, right?
Yes.
Okay. So a lot of the market these days has been go-go, Momo, juicy, growth-oriented. So let me just ask you this, just to make sure the audience understands and we get a flavor for this. You probably don't think that Tesla is a value stock.
I think it's a good car.
Yeah. All right.
But as a stock, not so much.
Not so much. What about Netflix?
I like the service.
Yep.
But not so much for the stock, you don't know.
So if they could be Netflix in your Tesla, it would be great.
This way.
Okay. And the same goes through maybe for a variety of other than names, maybe some of the internet related. Now let me kind of switch over. What about a Google?
I think Google is probably reasonably priced, maybe slightly undervalued. Maybe Google doesn't worry me. I mean, Google is, it's fine.
Okay. And Microsoft? I know you were it's a tough one, the Microsoft, right?
I have this love-hate relationship with Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
And I, as a value investor, I kind of like the balance sheet. I like the cash flows. And at the same time, I have a problem with the management. And the management has been replaced, which is good. But the problem is Microsoft is basically a turnaround story right now. Because, you don't, when you add 30,000 people to another 100,000 people, it's kind of harder to do a turnaround. And I'm referring to Microsoft buying Nokia. So we sold Microsoft last year, and we bought Oracle instead, because I felt, they have the moat, they have similar moats, except Oracle is run by a guy who really cares about Oracle's profitability, where Microsoft management really didn't. So.
Yeah, Larry Ellison, clearly, because he is so, the difference there is that Larry Ellison's fortune is pretty much tied up in Oracle. And
exactly.
He has a much, much greater, much closer to his well-being is much more tied to the well-being of the company versus, I think, the board and some of the people over at Microsoft, you're saying.
Well, Andrew, and actually there's a small distinction as well. I mean, you're absolutely right, but there's also another point. Like Bill Gates or Ballmer, Steve Ballmer, they really don't care about being rich. I mean, in a sense, either they have $20 billion or $5 billion, they don't care. Larry Ellison is probably the only billionaire I know that actually cares of being the richest person in the world. And as you mentioned, the only way for him to be the richest person in the world is for the Oracle price to go up. For that to happen, it has to make more money. So he's extremely competitive. And when you have a competitive person who owns 25% of the company, I think I'm better than management in the Oracle's mode.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel more comfortable being in Oracle than being in Microsoft.
Okay. So. Now let me switch over for a second here. So again, this market has been identified. When I say this market, I'm talking about, let's just really focus in on the last 2 or 3 months, because there's where we saw this, you know, ridiculous spike, or this good spike, whatever you want to call it, that was just based on, you know, the fact that we have a resolution to the debt ceiling and the budget, which we don't, and that there was, no tapering forever, which it may be. And the new chair coming in from Bernanke to Yellen. Yellen is probably just as, or probably more, dovish. And the idea that, you know, a lot of companies beat earnings. Now, we both know that the earnings game is a game. And mm-hmm. we see that, okay, earnings did beat. But I think you would agree that revenues were definitely questionable. And they can't go on forever with revenues being flat, right?
Well, you know, David Einhorn, in his letter, said, he called it when every quarter companies will lower the guidance and then they beat it. So, if you keep lowering your guidance and then beating it, is it really beating you? It tells you about the quality of earnings.
Exactly. The quality of earnings. That's the right thing to say. So as a value investor, what do you look? I mean, just let's start from a blank piece of paper. You get a company. You don't know the name of the company. Mm-hmm. Okay. It's in front of you. What are you looking for?
So number one, it's almost like there are two distinct analyses. One is analysis of a company and another analysis of a stock. So the first thing I want to figure out, is that a good company? Does it have a competitive advantage? Does it have a good management? Does it have a good balance sheet? Does it have good, good cash flows? Then I look at the management also, not just from how they run the business, but also what does it do with its cash flows? How good is, historic, capital allocation record. And that kind of gives you a good company, it's return capital. That gives you a good company. And you kind of try to figure out how much is it worth. And you say it's worth $1. And then you say, based on everything I know about this, how much discount to its worth, how much discount do I want to pay for, do I need for this business? So, and you try to buy dollar, this dollar for less, would it be 50 cents or 70 cents or 40 cents? It's going to depend on the business.
So when you look at this, and you said return on capital, are you looking at like also an ROE, a return on equity?
Oh, it could be different things. It could be return on equity, return on capital. It's a general notion. It's not a specific number.
Okay, and with regard to the company, I mean, obviously, where does the in terms of, I guess I would say, the price-earnings ratio, do you look at that, mm-hmm. a PEG ratio? Because a lot of, here's why I'm asking this, because so many times you hear on the radio, on TV, and for everybody listening, you hear, it's cheap because its PE ratio is blah, or the mm-hmm. market is cheap or expensive because its PE ratio is whatever it is. And it always kind of rubs me a little bit that this one metric is what everybody focuses in on. And I want your comment on that.
I think you're making a very, very interesting question. You're asking a very interesting question. So the value of any company or any asset is a kind of present value of its future cash flows, right?
Yep.
So, and as you mentioned PEG ratio, and I don't like use PEG ratio for a reason that it assumes a certain growth rate forever.
Right.
Right. And so therefore, and also, based on a PEG ratio, a company that has no growth is worthless as well. So it's kind of, it doesn't work well at the extremes. So PE ratio is a rule of thumb. If you look at PE ratios, we look at price to free cash flows. But what we try to do when you value a company, we try to look at many different valuation metrics. It could be PE ratio, it could be price to free cash flows. That's, to be honest, we spend more time on that than on the PE ratio. We do discounted cash flow analysis. We do sum of parts analysis. So, and then we try to kind of get to different valuation ranges. So it is dangerous to, a company at 15 times earnings could be cheap, and a company at 10 times earnings could be expensive. And it really comes down to not what the earnings you see today, but what are the earnings going to be that 3 or 5 years from now? Company at trading at 8 times earnings, which earnings would decline by 50% next year, is really trading at 16 times earnings,
right.
You know, et cetera. So right. What you want to do, you want to kind of figure out what is the company's earnings power.
Now what about using a comparative PE? So you have two companies that are very similar, that have, let's look at Home Depot and Lowe's. I mean, those are pretty similar, right? I mean,
sure.
Yeah. I mean, is it okay to use a PE if you're going to use it to compare at least, okay, just on that, which is more expensive?
Well, this is, it gets kind of tricky because in this environment, you using comparative PEs is extremely dangerous because if you have one stock that is overvalued to 25 times earnings and you look at another stock that trades at 20 and you say, oh, well, this is kind of cheap because the other one is at 25. Well, if the other one is overvalued to 25 and it should be 15 times earnings, guess what? The one that trades at 20 times earnings is overvalued as well. So relative valuations are, they have a use, but you have to be extremely careful. And in this environment, you kind of benchmark into this a slightly bubbly valuation for the market in general. So we try to stick as much as possible to absolute PEs. Is the company cheap in absolute sense?
Right. On its own, on a standalone basis, yeah.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that it's a bit of a bubbly or frothy time period. And, obviously there are values that you could find out there. And again, we're talking about value investing. We're not talking about the whole momentum side of things, which would be the antithesis of this. Now, in terms of the valuation of companies, you know, we saw companies, miss earnings or miss revenues, and they were still a bit higher, right? We saw this throughout the quarter. What do you look at when that happens? I mean, obviously, you own the stock, you're all happy, but what does that tell you? Is it that the liquidity is out there that's, you know, incredible? Is it that people looking, the other thing that is the good side of this, well, people are looking past this quarter, even though they're saying, hey, they're guiding a little bit lower for next, they're being conservative. Is it just a glass is, you know, half full environment that's doing that? Or is there the potential for a lot better earnings? I mean, one of the things that we're seeing is that there's the current estimate that S&P earnings are going to grow by, I think, at least 10% next quarter. Yeah, you laughed. No kidding, you laughed. I mean, that's pretty laughable, right?
Yeah. No, so when you, and this is discussion, kind of a little bit micro discussion. Like, no, we're talking about, you know, a market of stocks, right? So I'm extremely generalizing. But if you look today at the, you know, at the S&P 500 or U.S. stock market in general, U.S. stocks have the highest profit margins ever. Corporate profit margins today are incredibly, incredibly high. And historically, these profit margins never remained high. Every time they got to the high level, they declined. So even though stocks may not look that expensive, you know, on the earnings that you see for this year or next year, in general, these earnings were probably going to be lower 2 or 3 years from now because profit margins will decline. So you're talking about, you know, company beat earnings this quarter, etc. The way I look at it, I would love my stocks to miss their earnings estimates for some temporary reason because that gives me an opportunity to buy more stock and that gives a company opportunity to buy more stock. And so I kind of don't, I'll be very honest, I don't judge performance of of the company's view, in our portfolio on a quarterly basis. When you look at companies that trade at very, very high valuations, they're owned by, kind of momentum managers. And those are the guys who care, who really care if they beat, miss earnings, etc. Because they hit that price for perfection.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Let's talk about a couple of the stocks that you actually have been writing about. You talked about, I guess this was September. The title of the article was "Why Do Investors Hate Apple and Are Dead Wrong?" Now, you mentioned a few things. You mentioned, obviously lackluster consumer feelings on the new iPhone release. Although it was a great review, and the surprise factor is left. I mean, the kind of, the idea that they're going to come out with some revolutionary new technology rather than an enhancement to the current is kind of overshadowing it. The thing that the R&D, the research and development costs are basically doubled recently. But you think that there is some things, and this is back in September now, but you definitely see some drivers for this stock moving forward, right?
Well, I think valuation is cheap, yeah. So Apple, I think there are a couple of things that are going against Apple psychologically. I mean, number one is the high stock price, not valuation, but the kind of the high stock price number. So when Apple stock goes up, yeah, I don't know, $4, it's, you know, it's over $5, it's 1%. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, but it sounds like a lot, you know. So yeah. People, you know, it's, you know, when Apple has a $15 day, it makes headlines, even though it's, you know, 3%, right? So I think the high stock price in absolute sense kind of goes against Apple, because I think it's amplifies news, good and bad. That's number one. Number two, Nokia and BlackBerry are the two late success stories that, you know, that companies that could do nothing wrong for years, and then they just blew up, you know, both of them have. So everybody compares Apple to those companies.
By the way, that's a little ridiculous.
I agree, but I think that's overshadows, you know, the psychology behind, you know.
In other words, when a company becomes great, this is what you're telling me then. So the thing is, when a company becomes great, and there's not been that many, but when it becomes great, it's bound to just fall apart.
Well, yeah, and think about it. I mean, those two companies dominated the space, right? The cell phone space. And then they became irrelevant. And, as, you know, the stock prices collapsed. So Apple is kind of put psychologically in the same category to some degree.
Okay.
Or at least that's depresses its multiple.
Right, right. Okay, I got you.
Okay. And also, I think people, and this is my biggest insight about Apple. And to be honest, that's all that matters, really. People look at Apple as a hardware company. And I think Apple is a brand which has incredibly high recurrence of revenue. Once you buy Apple, you're more likely to, you know, iPhone, you're more, the next phone you're going to buy is most likely going to be Apple phone as well. So the recurrence of revenue, so once you go Apple, you stay Apple. And I think that's extremely important, because that creates this predictability of revenues in a business that shouldn't really have much predictability of revenues.
Right, because of churn, because of the potential, for a while there was at the mobile phone carriers, you know, the churn rates were just ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the predictability was okay if you incorporated the potential churn, but the predictability of current users renewing was the problem.
That's right. And then, so think about this. Apple supports basically last three phones. You know, so if you have a phone that you bought 2 years ago, most likely it's not going to work with its next, you know, when Apple comes out with its new operating system. So you're going to have to buy another phone, and most likely it's going to be an Apple phone. So that recurrence of revenue is extremely important, because I think that makes Apple's cash flow so much more stable.
Well, now on Apple, it's interesting because I agree with you. It you know, from a value standpoint, if you really just step back for a second and forget everything and just look at the valuation and you look at the price, you're like, hello. I mean, first of all, you know what? At the end of the day, companies were very smart. Even though there's a higher dividend rate that was imposed, you know, they started issuing dividends. Why? Whether they knew it or not, there was going to be a mad dash towards yield. Mm-hmm. And that attracted a lot of money. And that was very good for those companies that were, you know, producing some kind of yield. Because years ago, we never had a technology company that was massive doing any dividends. Remember that?
That's right.
It was like, you're doing dividends, something's wrong with you. You know, you should be putting it back into R&D and expansion, et cetera. Now, Apple also, the second in the ComScore listing of users in terms of phones. Google's number one with their Android system, as we know. Although, I think, Apple gets much more credit for the smartphone business than you know, Google does, because it's so spread out with the different phones that they have, the different phone makers. In terms of the company itself, though, and the additional products they have, you know, because everybody looks at Apple these days as the iPhone and maybe some iMacs. Now, they have an incredible depth, though, of, I guess it would be called an ecosystem that feeds upon itself. So you have, right, you have the Apple phone, and then you have iTunes, and then you have the movies, and then you have the Apple TV, and then you have all this is a closed circuit.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that also helps the predictability of earnings, don't you?
No, absolutely. I mean, I'll give you a very simple example. My family, my brothers, my parents, etc., you know, they have iPads and iPhones. So when I share a picture, when we share pictures, we use Apple's, you know, we use iCloud. And that basically keeps us, you know, buying Apple products, because if somebody buys an Android, it's almost like a foreign object in our family ecosystem, you know, system. So yeah, no, absolutely, no, that's there's no question about it.
Yeah, I agree. And by the way, I really hate the fact that they changed the name to iCloud versus PhotoStream, because PhotoStream was much, I'm still getting lost on this. I mean, PhotoStream was a much more effective name.
I agree with you.
I mean, I don't know what they did that for. I use it a lot. As a matter of fact, I have all my family and all that. I was in Morocco, and I'm just popping them pictures all day long.
It's kind of like, you know, to be honest, I think PhotoStream or iCloud is a competition to Facebook to some degree, because because I, you know, when I take a picture of my kids and I share it with my immediate family, I don't need to share it with, you know, with some strangers on Facebook. I just want to see, you know, and also it limits number of people that see this, you know, this picture. So, and my wife actually would not allow me to put pictures of our kids on Facebook.
Okay.
So this, you know, so I think that's actually a good competition to Facebook in my mind.
And it's more, well, Instagram also has the same kind of thing if you want to make a very small grouping out of it, but this is much more personalized.
No question about it. Also, what you made, let me make another point about the R&D, Apple's R&D. Because one of the points I made in the article is that everybody, you know, the Apple, since Steve Jobs passed away, Apple really has not come out with a revolutionary product, right?
Yep.
Everything that came out so far was basically kind of a small evolutionary, you know, kind of product.
Right.
But over the last 2 years, Apple's R&D almost doubled. And a number of products hasn't. So my feeling is, and I could be wrong about this, that when you really just basically, if you think about Apple, they just make one product outside of PCs. It's really iPod in different sizes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's really, you know, so when your R&D doubles over two and a half year period, you must be working on something in those labs. So, it's something they still have to prove that they can do it.
Well, we don't even know what it is. I mean, they're talking about a watch, but wasn't it Samsung just flopped on their watch?
Oh my God! When it came out with that watch, and I think they rushed it out just to be, you know, ahead of Apple. I thought it was pathetic. I thought it was a, you know, it's almost like a Seiko watch from the 80s catalog.
I agree. I don't understand the whole thing. Well, let me just say one thing, and I think I mentioned this before. They made the same mistake that BlackBerry did. And BlackBerry came out with their first playbook. You had to have the BlackBerry to power the whole thing and to communicate. Yeah. And they did the same, and that was a bomb. And then they come, anyway. All right, let's move on, because there's another one that a stock that I want to talk about, which is definitely not as well known as Apple. And you talk about this in November, and it's a company called Tesco. Now, Tesco is, would you say that it is Walmart of Europe, maybe?
I think it's a Walmart of UK for sure,
mm-hmm,
right?
Yeah.
It has a 30% market share in UK's grocery business. So it's basically the largest retailer in UK by far.
And people have to eat, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So the thing is that, you know, there's a few things depend on this. I mean, one of the fascinating things about grocery stores is that their margins are so ridiculously low, but it's like a slot machine.
Yeah.
You know, the slot machines, they promise a 99% return, right?
That's right.
And I'm sitting there going, wow, no. Let's think about this. That's even 98, 97, whatever it is. That means that every single time I put money in, the casino's making 1%.
That's right.
And that's not a bad deal, because all you have to do is sit these stupid machines there and you just shove your money in. And let's say you get back all your money all the time, except for 1%. They're taking a 1% spiff on you, and that's how the grocery stores work. They line the shelves with low margin items because they get it from the manufacturer, and they're just redistributing. Most groceries and stores are mostly just redistributors of a product, right? And it's not their own. Some have their own little products, but, you know, it's not their own. So their margins are very, very small on those because they have to stay competitive. But that's okay, because all they're doing is warehousing it and you're buying it. So, you know, this, they're like the slot machine with 1% or whatever. Now, what is it about this particular grocer? Now, because it's in Europe, although, again, a lot of it in the UK, what is it that you are intrigued about here? Because you would think that, you know, with European markets slowing down and you know, the continuation of the problems, that, you know, it may have a bit of a tighter consumer.
Yeah, so I've been following Tesco for years. I think the first time I looked at it was, a few years ago when Warren Buffett bought a stake in the company. And I thought at the time it was kind of fully valued. So, but anyway, we've been following it for years. And Tesco problems came from the fact that it already has a 30% market share in UK, and it's very difficult to grow there. So it started to invest outside of UK, and outside of UK, it had a mixed success. I mean, it came to United States and it spent almost $2 billion in the United States in California, and they failed. They went to China, and in China, their strategy was they started to open stores from both coasts. So they lacked scale. So that was something I was worried about. And also they had the Eastern Europe was not doing that well, and they had some business there. So, but over the last 6 months, a lot of things have changed. Number one, they admitted that U.S. was a failure, and they got out of the United States. They, you know, it was a $2 billion lesson for them, but, you know, they're out of the United States. In China, I thought what they did there was brilliant. They took all their stores and folded them, and merged them with the largest retailer in China.
Is that Fast Retailing, or is that, who is that?
It's a company called CRE. It stands for something, and I don't remember what.
But China, really excellent.
It's exactly. Yeah, I like that. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And so they merged it with that retailer, and they own 20% of a company that's profitable and has the scale. And the best part is Tesco is going to self-fund itself. So Tesco will not have to put up any more capital for China. So what you have left is this. You have Asia, excluding China, which is basically South Korea, Thailand, and Malaysia, where Tesco is number one and number two. They've been extremely, by the way, Walmart tried to get into South Korea and they failed miserably.
Well, let me just give the backdrop. What were the countries you mentioned for a second? Those three, Thailand,
Malaysia, and South Korea.
Okay, let me just, you know, have you been there, by the way?
I haven't, no.
Okay, let me tell you what the competition is. Okay, the competition is something that it depends on where you are. It's called a sorry sorry.
Uh-huh.
And a sorry sorry is a tin shack on a corner.
Okay.
With old food with a lot of dust probably on the cans and all that line, you know, maybe the room is, I don't know, maybe it's, I'll make the benefit out of it. 12 by 12 is the entire store. And they're all over the place. And or they could be right outside your house, by the way, because people just buy things from other people. And a lot of these countries, that is the main way of getting little tidbits here. And it's like they're 7-Eleven, I guess. So when you have something coming in here and, you know, you have it in a place that is emerging, now they're, you know, it's a whole different thing. Listen, years ago in New York, we didn't have Kmart. We didn't have Walmart. No Home Depot. You went to the stationery store. You went to a variety of smaller department stores. And you know, we didn't have this kind of massive store. And I would think that most Europeans or even Asians, they came and you know, from years ago, looked at some of the stores that we have that are all in ones. I mean, you walk into a Walmart or something, or Target or whatever it is. Is there anything you can't buy there, really?
And you're right. You may be right about Thailand and Malaysia, but in South Korea,
South Korea is different.
It's different. And they have, what's amazing about South Korea, they have succeeded where everybody else has failed. You know, they have extremely profitable business in South Korea. And they're solid number two, and they're doing very well there. So, and then you have let's talk about UK for a second. In UK is basically it's obviously in Europe. What I like about UK, a couple things. Number one, UK economy is recovering.
Yeah.
And almost everybody agrees that it's a real recovery and it's unlikely to go in double deep recession. So it's a real recovery. So Tesco has been investing a lot of money over the last couple of years. And but that those investments kind of got nowhere because the economy was not doing well. As the economy recovers, you're going to start seeing the benefits of those investments. And that's point number one. Point number two, about a few months ago, Tesco came out and said, we're going to slow down of opening new stores in UK. You know, because in all fairness, the return on capital incremental stores was not very good. But the best part was this. The competitors came out and said, we're going to do the same. So now you're going to see a lot more rational pricing, and you get a lot less competition for, you know, in UK. I mean, at least you're not going to see a lot of competition for new stores. So I think, you know, in the UK, business is extremely profitable. They have a great competitive advantage. And if you look at Costco as a whole, you basically can buy this company at about 11 times depressed earnings, or about 9 times, you know, normalized earnings. You know, if you know, think about Walmart is trading about 15 times, you know, kind of normalized earnings today. So I can buy, you know, I can basically buy it for about half the price. I mean, I'm sorry, 50%, you know, 30% discount.
Hmm. Interesting. So you don't, this is more of a value story with a growth kicker.
Yes, and a 4+% dividend.
Yeah. Yeah. And the symbol, by the way, symbol, so you, everybody knows that, is T as in Tom, S as in Sam, C, D, Y. So, what's the downside here? What's the downside of this? What do you see as the potential areas that could be a concern for this company?
I think, you know, I guess if UK, if I'm wrong about UK economy and goes into double dip, that's, you know, that's going to hurt them. If they have a business in Europe, but they about 15% of revenue comes from Eastern Europe, if that gets worse, you know, that's going to hurt them. Stock-wise, I think downside is very limited. I mean, this is not a, you know, by the way, this is, I'm not recommending anybody to buy this stock.
Yeah, of course.
And I think everybody should go do their homework. But I think on this stock-wise downside is extremely limited. I think because, you know, I'm paying 11 times, and then the margins in UK are already very low, and they likely expand, not, you know, and the UK is about 2/3 of revenue, you know, of profitability.
Right.
So UK, that's what really matters.
Right.
So the margins in UK are unlikely to decline more, and most likely will go up.
Mm-hmm.
So I think stock-wise, I think there's very little downside. Upside, upside is this. Earnings will be probably 20% higher, you know, a couple years down the road. And PE will be 50% higher. So you basically could, I could see this, you know, the stock being 70-80% higher, you know, 3 years from now.
Mm, interesting.
Now, let's
wrap it up. You have a few books out. I know one of them is a little book, as they call it,
yes.
Right? And why don't you tell you about what the name of that is so they can grab it?
Yeah, sure. It's the Little Book of Sideways Markets.
Little Book of Sideways Markets. And that means that when markets aren't trending, what to do.
Right.
And what else? Where else can people find your information?
You know, I think they can subscribe to my articles on contrarianedge.com.
Okay, and we'll put that link on the show notes, of course. Vitaly Katsenelson, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Andrew, it's been my pleasure.
All right, talk to you soon, buddy. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
There's some good information for you, right? Can't say you don't get your money's worth here, right? You can't say it. Let's get back to some of the things I was talking about right before we talked to Vitaly. And I was talking about retail sales. That's going to be kind of interesting to look at, I think, because when you think about how, well, there has been a lot of headwinds, a lot of problems, a lot of issues, but people still seem excited. Maybe it's the wealth effect. We're going to see some CPI come out on the 20th as well, looking for a whopping 0.1% ex-food and energy. That's pretty light. Existing home sales will be also on the 20th, and we're going to have business inventories, and we're going to have, wonder of wonders, another Fed release. On 11/20, we're going to see the release of the Fed minutes. And then moving along, we'll have some jobs numbers, PPI, and pretty much wrapping it up for the week, you'll have the Philly Fed business outlook looking for 16, where it was about 20 last time. That's a pretty big number last time. Now, when it comes to earnings, we're also going to be looking at some companies. We mentioned that. You're going to be seeing Deere and Company. Now, Deere, Caterpillar, and a few of the other players out there that are trying to compete with Japan probably got a little bit of a lift because the currency of Japan did, in fact, strengthen a little bit over the last quarter or so, but it's starting to turn around again, so we'll see what their outlook looks like. Lowe's and Home Depot, they're really a product of the housing market. But the big one's going to be JCPenney. Now, JCPenney, obviously, we saw a lot of people bailing on it. They're looking for a loss of about $1.70 per share on about $2.8 billion of revenue. Now, estimates have really not been moving around very much recently, but there has been a lot of players, some of the hedge fund guys, getting on board with this, thinking that, hey, you know what, maybe they bottomed out and it's going to be free reign from here. We're also going to see Green Mountain Coffee Roasters on the 20th. They are looking for 75 cents on 965. Now, those shares have been pretty beat up. And we'll see if there has been a lot more of a pushback due to the fact that there's a lot of other options out there right now. Sears, another one in the same genre as JCPenney, looking for about a loss of $3.14 on $8.2 billion. It's even worse. On $8.2 billion of revenue, they're going to lose $3.50 or $3.2. JCPenney's only looking at $2.8 billion and losing $1.70. So it's like the more money they make, the more money they lose. Kind of crazy. The Gap, very much a really very aggressive play right now. The Gap came out with some same-store sales recently, and now they're looking for about 71 cents. The Abercrombie & Fitch looking for about 45 cents. Pandora's coming out. We see that, 6 cents. It doesn't seem like the Apple radio has really hurt them very much. I'd also be looking at the Fresh Market. We saw that their counterpart, the Whole Foods, came out with a pretty negative report and outlook. And they usually don't. They usually beat a little bit more than they did. So we're looking for about 26 cents there on about $373 million revenue. Now, I will tell you that this earnings report, these key earnings reports with the recent revisions, a whole report is on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and you can get that on Monday morning and with ongoing research and things that we talk about as well over there, or just follow me on Twitter, at Andrew Horowitz, and you can listen to me on, of course, this show and DH Unplugged. I'll also mention to you that we're making some headway on some great webinars. If you haven't attended these webinars, these are awesome. We've had Corey Rosenblum teaching a few things. He's actually doing some private and group workshops, some mentoring or coaching sessions for trading. Cool stuff. Really, really cool stuff. So you got to check that out over on triggercharts.com. All the events, just click on the events button there and you'll find out. And then you got to head over. We got a lot of new stocks that we had alerted over the last couple of weeks on Trigger Point Research at a new high for the stocks that we have been tracking. You got to check that out. Get your 14-day free subscription. If you haven't done that, it's really cool. We text message you or email you the alerts, the prices, what to do, when to do it, what not to do, etc. Now, I'll see you next week because I'm going to be here, and I hope that you will be too. It's going to be approaching Thanksgiving shortly, and that's no reason not to be listening. Send your friend a little alert. Hey, listen, I listen to this guy Horowitz. Pretty good stuff. Send him a little note. I appreciate that. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.